Hi, I'm Ben Rizzuto, wealth strategist at Janus Henderson Investors. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
This episode, we're stepping out of the newsroom to bring you highlights from the Future of Everything Festival. For 3 days, Wall Street Journal editors and industry minds gathered in New York to examine how advancements in science and technology are revolutionizing business, culture, and society. This was recorded in front of a live audience on May 8th at Spring Studios in Tribeca.
The Future of Everything, a look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
Amy Webb is the founder of the Future Today Institute and teaches at NYU's Stern School of Business. She uses her backgrounds in game theory, sociology, programming, economics, and statistics to forecast the future. She joins my colleague, Wall Street Journal editor Nikki Waller, on stage to discuss artificial intelligence's growing role in our daily lives.
Go back for a second to the third era of computing. Can you expand on that a little bit and trace the evolution for us? We have a very knowledgeable audience, but for me, really.
Sure. So some of the very first, how far back do we go? Some of the very, very first references to computing were in the 1500s and 1600s. And the very, very first era had to do with making calculations. So this is tabulation. The second era of computing was programmable systems. So the laptops that you're using, the basic word programs, that sort of thing. This third era of computing has to do with huge sets of data and algorithms and processes that are predicated on making decisions for us. And this is the, again, when we think about AI in the present, it's easy for us to look around and feel like not a lot is happening. I would argue the present modalities of AI isn't what's important. It's all of the underlying infrastructure and the cracks in the foundation that currently exist, and the rush to commercialization, and all of the other pieces that are a part of this big ecosystem, which are being built in the present and will have dramatic impacts on us starting, you know, in the very near future. That third era of computing ought to be our frame of mind, and the challenge is that we're in it. We are already going through that transition. You can think of it as a sort of explosion happening in slow motion. We just can't see it because we're in the middle of it.
So, who is in charge of this third era of computing?
Who's in charge? Where's the switch? There is no switch, and nobody's in charge. So there's no singular person. However, there is and always has been a very, very small group of people thinking about and working on the problem. The originators were early philosophers and mathematicians and scientists who were endeavoring to think about the mind and the container, the body, and what is human thought and what would it mean for machines to think. And that's always been a relatively small and, by the way, homogenous group of people tackling that question. Today, it's still a relatively small, homogenous group of people who are thinking about the future of AI and working on the future of AI. And while it might seem like everybody's got an AI startup, in reality, it's a very small, narrow group of folks who are based in the United States, to some extent in Canada, but then also in China. So our entire future of artificial intelligence really comes back to what I call the Big Nine. These are the Big Nine companies who are doing the predominant amount of research, who control overwhelmingly all of the funding, and who are themselves deciding the strategic direction that the future of AI is moving into.
And those Big Nine, are they predominantly Western companies? Are they international? What's the breakdown for everyone here?
So the Big Nine are, and I'm not going to go in order of importance at the moment, but six of them are in the United States, and three of them are in China. So in China, it's Tencent, Alibaba, and Baidu. And in the United States, it's Alphabet, which is Google, Amazon, IBM, to a lesser extent, Facebook, and then also Microsoft and Apple. So these are the, you know, and the challenge is that starting in the 1960s, when there was still quite a bit of outside investment that wasn't tied to companies who were trying to commercialize something, today, overwhelmingly, the money is flowing in for commercial purposes. So there's not a lot of money left over for things like basic research. And there's so much pressure because there's so much money and so much investment in AI that there's not a lot of time to stop and sort of think through what are the implications, what are the risk and opportunity scenarios that are not tied to ROI.
So you're saying there's not really that many executives at these big nine companies who are stopping to stroke their chins and say, gosh, you know, like, what are the ethics of what we're doing? Or do you see that as happening, but really in isolated pockets and not in a unified way right now?
Right. So these companies have ethicists, or they work with ethicists. They have futurists. So there are people in the mix who are helping to think through some of these things. The challenge is time. So there was something called the AI winter that happened in the 60s after funding dried up because there was a lot of promises made and not a lot delivered, which didn't have to do with the theoretical constructs. It had to do with compute power. In the 90s, a Canadian computer scientist first imagined the concept of neural nets, which was like a radically crazy idea.
Can you explain that concept here for everybody?
Sure. So it's difficult to separate biology from AI because the two have always sort of intertwined. So this concept in the 90s was that just like humans learn by observing through reinforcement learning, perhaps it might be possible to train machines to learn in the same way. So not just mimicking, but intuiting and like all these other things. So there have always been really interesting and sort of radical ideas and suggestions, but we didn't have enough compute power. The challenge is that when the impetus is tied to finance and profit fails to materialize, you wind up with problems. And I would argue that in the United States, there's this rush. If you've heard the expression, data is the new oil, which everybody at some point has heard, there's a couple of reasons.
Lots of nods of agreement in the room. Yes.
Right, so there's a couple of reasons for that. One, just like in the days of the oil rush, everybody's rushing to like put their stake in and make money while the money's there to be had. But also because we are the ones generating the data that make these systems work. So part of the third era of computing is predicated on all of the data that just by virtue of being alive, we are creating and shedding. And the companies with the capability of mining and refining and productizing that data are the ones who stand to make a profit. And part of making that profit enables those companies to do bigger, better things, some of which are altruistic and good for society, like maybe curing cancer, others of which are tied strictly to business. And if you think about it that way, if data is the new oil, I'm going to ask, you can ask me a question later, but now I'm going to ask you a question. Data is the new oil, right, in this scheme, in AI. Who then has the most data on Earth? Which country? China. China has billions of people and totally different restrictions and ideas about privacy and ethics and all the rest. I'm way off on a tangent.
Okay. We'll bring it back in. But I mean, actually, I would love for you to describe, I mean, obviously we're here talking about the future, but walk us through the present. What is happening right now in AI development? Like, tell us what's going on in China and what's happening in the U.S. and how those approaches reflect different mindsets, different priorities, even different beliefs among the people.
Right, so there's a bunch of stuff happening. So again, all of us are here today as a result of AI in some way. The email system, the ticketing system, like all of those things are examples of artificial narrow intelligence, which has been around for a while. So we all interact, and for people who say AI is not here, it's a long trajectory, you know, it depends on how you define that. Now, what's happening today is moving us away from systems that have gotten good at doing fairly narrow things to more comprehensive systems. So this is like artificial general intelligence. And, you know, that ranges from being able to have a meaningful conversation to autonomous vehicles to, you know, all different types of systems. But those systems, forget about robots. The whole thing is about making decisions. And as humans, we do two things. We make decisions, but we have choices, right? We can choose. What we are actually doing is assigning out to machines that mimic our intelligence, but don't necessarily have consciousness the way that we perceive or define it. We are asking machines and training them to make decisions on our behalf. The way that they do this is using data, like an initial corpus, an initial set of parameters, and humans who train them. So that's today. But what we're moving towards is our systems without humans in the loop. So systems that start to learn on their own, make decisions on their own, based on some of the parameters. What some people are starting to see is that that small homogenous group of people in those nine companies aren't doing a really good job of representing everybody's best interests, and they're not thinking things all the way through. In China, it baffles me that this is not something the United States is taking more seriously. Politics aside, and I'm politically independent, but politics aside, this is the absolute worst time to have people in the Trump administration there making key decisions, because they're all, you know, many of them are sort of AI deniers.
What does that mean to be an AI denier?
Ask Steve Mnuchin, who doesn't think that AI is a thing or isn't going to affect the workforce or anything else. I mean, it's you know, when you look at what's happening in China, China has devoted a huge chunk of its sovereign wealth fund to the future of AI, to training people, to building out systems and services. They've got schools where they're teaching kids at a very, very early age. And they also don't have, again, the same ideas about privacy and human rights that we do in the United States. And as a result of that, you know, China has some unbelievably good facial recognition systems, like really good posture recognition systems. There's a company called SenseTime, which just got a $600 million, I think, or $800 million infusion from Alibaba. These things are so good that financial institutions trust them, so that you can pay with your face. If it's a dark room, these companies don't just need your face. They can look at the capillaries beneath your skin. They can look at your gait. This is complicated stuff. Anyhow, so China is building out this future in a way that is fast, that is targeted, and I think could change the balance of power and shift economic focus during a critical time when the United States is retreating.
And walk us through a little bit of what that means in China. You know, I spoke with one of the founders of SenseTime, a recent journal event, and one of their biggest clients, of course, is the Chinese government, in addition to law enforcement. And the journal has done some really great reporting on how China is using some of these AI-assisted tools to keep track of its population. Can you walk everyone here through a couple of scenarios, what that means? You know, if you are jaywalking, what does it mean in a facial recognition society?
Like, sure.
Not a big deal here in New York.
Yeah, no, in New York, if you don't jaywalk, right, then everybody gets upset with you. So you were in China. I used to live in China. So this is not necessarily considered as strange there as it would be here. But so this technology is now being deployed in areas. So imagine yourself at a street corner, like in Midtown. The midtown of China. Digital billboards. If you jaywalk, you're recognized. Your face is thrown up on that digital billboard with your name, where you work. A message is sent out over Weibo, which is a social network, letting your employer know that you've jaywalked and that you've publicly shamed yourself and the people that you know. So that kind of sounds silly to us, but that's actually kind of a big deal over there. But it also fits into other areas of society. So you've probably at this point heard about the social ranking system, which is actually now, and I think the journals covered this as well, but you know, if you have done things that don't that sort of run afoul of what's considered to be upstanding behavior in China, you know, you have points deducted. And once you have so many points deducted against you, you'll find yourself like on a no-fly list. There's 2 million people in China who can't fly now because of artificial intelligence. Because the data that they generate, because they are alive, combined with collaborative robotics and smart cameras and recognition systems, right, all of the hardware that is connected to the third era of computing, right, now makes their lives a lot harder. There are people who can't get their kids into certain schools, you know, whose lives are really, truly changed.
And that is a true New York nightmare as well.
Of course it is.
So imagine.
It's already hard enough.
But, you know, I mean, what are the upsides to some of this? As far as, these systems that can identify who we are, I mean, are there security benefits, or are they outweighed by the very real downsides that you describe here?
So let me just quickly level set. This is all, the work that I do is all data-driven. So I'm not sort of looking into a crystal ball and thinking things through. So one of the models that we built had to do with shifts and changes in mobile. So I would argue that this is the beginning of the end of all smartphones this year. 10 years from now, we'll start to see a vastly different ecosystem. I know that's hard for us all to imagine because we're all glued to our phones, but all the data are there. The early signals are there. So if we assume that within a decade, we're moving into an era in which we no longer have smartphones as we know them, this kind of recognition technology becomes critical because it means that we are interacting with machines using voice, using image and object recognition in other ways, and biometric tools. Mm-hmm. So in a way, you know, that's potentially good. It's potentially more secure. On the other hand, anytime benevolent technology gets invented, like some jerk, you know, finds a different use for it. So the very same technology that would allow you to just recognize, so Snapchat, Snap, right? Snap filters. You can use Snapchat to augment your face in fun and interesting ways. And that's AI. The same underlying technology was also used at the end of last year to do something called deepfakes, which is swapping somebody else's face onto a porn star in porn videos. It started with well-known people, and then it sort of trickled down. And, you know, people's neighbors, people's coworkers, kids were finding that they were in these things. So it doesn't mean that the technology shouldn't continue to march forward. It means that literally right now, every human alive needs to think good and hard and long about ourselves as oil and how we're being mined and refined and in exchange for what, right? And that also implies, as we're moving towards this future without the mobile devices that we currently have and where more decisions are being made for us, in the very near future, you're not going to be in a situation where you're deciding between Android and iOS, right? You're going to be in a situation probably where your entire life is, your life's operating system, you know, is probably Amazon or Google in the United States, and in China, you know, an amalgam of those three. And it's going to be a lot harder, you know, if you want to swap your phone, it's already hard to swap between Apple and Android. Mm-hmm. Like, imagine every aspect of your life being tied up in a way that's not transparent, not clear to you, doesn't make a lot of sense. Our lives are going to become both more complicated and less easy to control than I think we realize. We're going to have a lot less autonomy than we realize. And sorry, one last thing.
I've given up all autonomy. It's great.
But I don't want to give the impression that, like, these companies can and should earn a profit. They have a fiduciary responsibility. That is what they are set up and designed to do. I don't begrudge them that. However, their responsibility is a fiduciary one, and sometimes the goals of business and the goals of what's best for the farther future of humanity don't necessarily align.
So who steps in then? I mean, who becomes the AI police? Do we all band together out by the snacks and make a Bill of Rights? Or is it the leading researchers? Is it some of the people who are on stage with us today?
Right.
What do you see as being the best way to actually form a corpus of unified ethics and practices?
So this is a really challenging question. This is totally not going to make sense to some people probably, but I've got Asimov in my head, and I'm thinking about Foundation, right, and this, like, shadow government. We don't have a shadow government of AI worldwide, people who are able to make decisions and enforce them. So this is really nuanced and complicated. Thankfully, we have people like Kate, who will be up here in a little while, who is exploring this with her colleagues at the AI Now Institute. There are lots of pockets of people. Stanford's got a longitudinal study where a bunch of people are looking at this. So on the one hand, there are pockets of people who are taking a critical look, but I don't think enough is going to change quickly without more of us involved. And the reality is that we can still have a successful commercial future while changing the developmental track of AI to be more inclusive, again, to sort of think through some of these thorny issues, but we have to make the decision to do that. Now, that still doesn't tell us a lot about China. Right, so
shadow government or no, whether we manage to assemble this thing, China's going to do what China wants.
Sure, and again, like, China just changed its political structure a little bit, just a tiny bit. Everybody was really hoping that election was going to go that way. Right. So this is a problem, and it's going to require a wider number of people thinking critically about this and talking and doing the research and putting in the legwork, because it's complicated and nuanced.
in the spirit of the future of everything and in the spirit of an event that is largely about prediction, Amy, I'm going to also ask you to make a prediction. What is one prediction you can make by 2025? What's one way we'll see AI in our lives that is not present today?
So 2025 is actually pretty near to the future. And I would also just say that as a futurist, I don't make predictions. But if I were to think through what's coming, talking to machines will be a much bigger part of everyday life. And some of the modeling we've done shows that 50% of the interactions that we have with machines in industrialized worlds will be using our voices. A lot changes when you are talking to rather than typing on a machine. And it shifts our expectations. It also creates interesting new divides. It means that some people will not have as much compute power and accessibility as others. So,
great. Well, that is all the time we have. Amy Webb, thank you so much for joining us.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced by Anthony Green, Brian Gutierrez, Kristen Schwab, and Laura Sem. John Wurdock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We had help with this episode from The Wall Street Journal's Nikki Waller, Kim Last, and Joanna Stern, with special thanks to festival organizers Karen Annis, Catherine Sterling, Andrea Acosta, Robin Wood Saylor, and Anna Rafdahl. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong in New York.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.